The Labor and Commerce Committee to order. We've got two bills before us today, House Bill 412, House Bill 269. We need to be out of here by 2 for floor session. We have attendance Representative Parnell, Representative Bruckman, Representative Taylor, Representative Finkelstein. First bill up is House Bill 412. We completed public testimony on 412 throughout the teleconference system and people present. We're now just into markup and action on it. Any committee comments on 412? We're on, but I don't think this bill.
Thank you. I would move that this would, I would support this bill, like to see it pass out. I think his facility is in the case of his disease, and at least in the initial stages, once you discover you are, I think there are many medical procedures that are necessary to find out that there aren't worse problems with your body. So I do feel that the insurance industry ought to cover at least the initial, at the minimum, the initial medical procedures to rule out any other causes. It would be nice if we could afford to go all the way or continue the process. To make a long story short, support the bill and would move it out if that's what your wishes.
Okay, the bill is removed with individual recommendations. I personally have a lot of problems with the bill, but I'll express that in the committee report. The further discussion on the motion before us.
No, I'd object. At this point, I'm not prepared to vote out of committee.
Okay, the objection has been made. Is there further discussion on the motion? I may have, let me remark for the record that I probably share Representative Taylor's concerns. But I do feel like I've done as much investigation as I can and as the committee can. Any other committee members? Representative Parnell?
Yeah, I'm not enthused about it either, Mr. Chairman.
But you don't have objection to passing out the individual recommendation.
What's the next stop? Yes.
Next stop is finance.
Oh,
next stop is that? Oh, then Hess, then finance. Hess, then finance. Do you have rejection?
To letting him review it? No.
Okay. I'm just trying to gauge people's reaction to the motion. Okay, motion has been made. There's been objection. All in favor of the motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed indicate by saying nay. Not voting. I think we have to have 4 people on record in order for there to be an action, at least.
I'll vote to move it on to the next committee for discussion.
Okay. So the bill passes individual recommendations. Representative.
I'd have to object, Mr. Chairman. I can't. We have to have 4 for a quorum. So I'm here to pass the bill out. The motion has to also pass by a majority of the committee, which is 4, not 3. That's why we got legal opinion on that.
Representative Taylor, you might be right, but I think we also got a legal opinion to the contrary. But I don't want to try to resolve that now. You may well be right. The committee did just take an action. How about if you can dig out, I'll hang on to this long enough for you to dig out anything you can provide to us, and I'll dig out whatever I can on this issue.
I don't have it with me, Mr. Chairman. I think
you can provide it later. I'll hang on.
It was addressed to the committee, if I remember right, the attorney opinion that came out of Ledge Research.
Well, let me ask Catherine if she
do you recall?
Catherine's telling me is that we had conflicting opinions between the Rules Committee and the opinions. I sort of recall this a little better now because we had some other bill that fit this category. Clearly, 4 is a quorum, but does it require a 4-0 vote then to take action?
It does.
Well, I think that's a disputed point. The Rules Committee, which we have to rely on to a degree, because it's our body rather than the advice that rules. The advice is just advisory in this situation. Indicates otherwise that if we have a quorum, we can take an action on a 3-1 vote.
The reason, Mr. Chairman, that you really don't want to do that, is that you end up with the possibility of majority of your own committee being opposed to that action.
How about this?
I don't think it's wise to do it, and I do believe I'm correct on the interpretation that it takes four votes to move the bill out of a committee of seven people.
How about this?
Six votes is certainly ruled up in finance. They don't move one out without a vote of six.
I do recall that from the legal opinion, and I'll get that and circulate to anyone who's interested. But I also do recall the advice from the Rules Committee that we can act on 3-1. And I actually, if I remember correctly, someone brought this up on the floor, and we had a discussion on the floor at some point, didn't we, at this point? Maybe it was in the caucus. There was some discussion that occurred in some larger body about this issue on a previous one. But let's do this. I will, based on the point made, I will hold on to the bill until our next meeting. We have the votes we've taken. We just won't pass it on because there's a dispute on this issue. Maybe we'll have more members and we can resolve it then. I think that's fine. Let's move on now to the next bill, House Bill 269. We've been through all the public testimony. We do have online at least one person. We may get others to answer questions. I'd like to confine ourselves to outlining the CS before us and then going through amendments, because I'd really like to complete our action on this bill. We've had it before us four or five times, I think, now. Have we discussed the CS and the elements in it yet?
No.
Okay, should we have Fawn do that? Okay. Here's where we are. We previously had in every packet a series of amendments, one of which I prepared, setting up a registration system versus a licensing system. It was one of the points that had come out as an alternative in the testimony. That's been incorporated into a new CS. The CS that's dated 4/13/92.
LLC.
This is acceptable to the sponsor of the bill, Representative Boyer. So the first question is, do we want to accept this CS?
I would so move.
Okay, the CS has been moved. Is there objection to adopting the CS?
No objection.
Okay, CS adopted. Now I'd like to proceed through a series of amendments, which...
Okay.
Well, you can eject each one.
Is this the
pack? It's a packet of amendments 1-10. They were submitted by Aetna, at least. I don't know if there's other insurance companies interested. There's some of them I'd like to offer, and I will offer those. I'd like to confine any testimony we have on this to relatively brief answers to questions posed by committee members to issues they'd like to address on those amendments. First amendment offers amendment number one. What's at issue here is the level of information that's got to be provided. The review standards, criteria, and procedures, or a summary of those. And I realize that summary is vague. I do not think this resolves the problem completely. I think part of it is going to be clearly left to regulations, because summary could be one page saying we've got these standards. Obviously, it's going to take more than that to address the concerns of the of this bill. But equally broad is review standards, criteria, and procedures. I mean, the testimony we've had could mean it come in giant stacks of material that is going to be voluminous. Any comments or any questions anyone wants to ask on amendment number one?
Who's offering
it? I'm offering amendment number one. I'm not necessarily offering them all. An objection to me. I'll assume that there's objection on all of them. How about that?
Good.
Representative Brock.
I think I see what you're getting at, that a summary is certainly easier to read and understandable for especially for patients. I wouldn't object to having both, but I think I do not want to delete the language that's in the bill, the entire system.
Let me say, on every amendment I'm going to offer, there's clearly two sides to every one of these things. I'm not saying I'm right, you're wrong.
Okay.
I'm saying I like my arguments better than yours, that's all.
I object, yeah.
I'm history like yours better than mine.
Mm-hmm.
Further discussion or questions on amendment number one?
Still trying to see how.
Okay. This is page 3, line 4. It's basically just a modifier that adds in the summary. Because later on we're talking about the plan available and the review standards, criteria, and procedures. Here we're just saying it's the summary will be satisfactory.
Both should be available upon demand.
Hmm?
I mean, upon demand,
the
entire,
is, if the issue is should the this amendment were to pass, they would not have to necessarily provide the detailed review standards, criteria, and procedures.
They should be required to provide the entire thing if requested. You know, I appreciate summaries, believe me. But if I want the entire package, the patient should be allowed to have it by law. In fact, by law, we are entitled, current law says that we are.
Is the is everyone prepared to vote on this amendment? We got a memo here we're distributing now, April 14th, from Regal FB that goes through the first six amendments. Which basically is making the argument that Representative Brock was making.
Could your language include Representative Brookman has just said so that they can have a summary and if they choose they can have a full report?
Well, it's sort of immaterial.
It's not worried about that.
Right. It's, if they have to provide all the material, summary is sort of irrelevant. I mean, they can provide or not provide it. It's the issue here and the objection by the companies is providing all the material. And Representative Brooklyn's point is that it significantly weakens this disclosure if they don't have to provide it. It isn't. The purpose of the amendment isn't to make a summary available. It's to avoid making all of it available.
Based on that, I would not support it.
Okay. Is there further discussion or questions on amendment number one? All in favor of amendment number one, indicate by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, indicate by saying nay.
Nay.
Amendment failed. Next amendment. Okay, that was by a 1-3 margin. Next amendment is, I'd like to offer this amendment number 3.
Okay.
What happened to 1-2?
Well, anyone's free to offer. These are amendments that Edna prepared, and I'm offering ones that I agree with. If anyone else agrees with others, they're free to offer. Okay. Actually, if you want to do two, we can do them in order.
I would move amendment number 2 for purposes of discussion. I had a big problem with, I was talking with Ray about this. I had a big problem with the terms sufficient numbers, which I understand you've tossed around in appropriate things like that. Who defines what sufficient is? Who defines what appropriate is? And amendment 2 tries to address that. It doesn't reach it exactly because it cuts out the last part of it. But under amendment number 2, at least we're tightening it down so that we see that the requirement that a private review agent has available the services of registered nurses or mental health professionals. It would seem to me the only reason they would have them there is that they're appropriate to the service that they're offering them, so that they would hire anybody else. Am I reading it wrong?
Oh, you're reading it horribly wrong. This would gut the entire bill.
What would it do?
Well, in my opinion, it would gut the entire bill. It's allowing physicians that are unfamiliar or that are not trained in that specialty.
Why would you hire somebody?
Why would you go to
a specialty?
For the same reason that you go to a specialist, if that person's trained, you know.
Well, that's true, but they wouldn't have anybody on staff who's not trained. But they, I mean, whatever area that they're supposed to be reading up.
This is allowing them not to be trained in that area. The way I read this is that the physician would be unfamiliar with those particular diagnostic techniques and procedures. You know, that allowing that physician to to supervise an area they're unfamiliar with. In other words, picking an MD that has the say-so over coverage from a gynecologist or a heart doctor. I mean, I think that's the exact opposite.
What do you do with the mental health professionals that you have, or physicians? I'm thinking more of physical. When I read physicians, I don't think in terms of mental health professionals.
I agree.
And that's where I'm trying to address it. For example, in Providence Hospital, this might work just fine. But when you have an off-premise operation, like human affairs in Alaska or something of that nature, and they have a physician service maybe available 6 or 8 hours. But it isn't even, if we change this to clinical physician, that might be more appropriate than just to say physician.
What's a clinical physician?
I think it would be somebody who would be more attending to a facility like Providence Hospital, neighborhood health services or something like that.
Is clinical a modifier or a definer?
I always thought it was. I'm not that proficient in language. But
it is for psychologists.
I don't know, I've just never heard it used as I've heard of, a guy specializing in obstetrics or gynecology or something.
Yeah.
I've never heard of a physician especially being called a clinical physician. A clinical physician to me just kind of is a generic term referring to where the guy worked. If he worked out of a clinic, worked out of a hospital, he'd be a bush physician, I guess, if he worked in the bush. But I never thought of it as being a modifier that would connote some level of training or expertise.
I guess I thought it was, but it may not.
I don't know.
Yeah,
that's what I'm asking.
Just to let me try to put this in context of some of the testimony we had. The as the bill stands, the requirement is that these determinations be made by people trained in the appropriate specialty area.
Yeah.
And the concern expressed by the companies is involved is the cost of that. If with the amendment, the effect is to leave it up to the to probably not require any additional people, any new people to come do it, and there's concerns with that as well. I'm not arguing for it now. I'm just trying to find the obviously there's an argument to be made that these determinations should be made by someone who understands that area. There's also a cost argument about what it costs to have. Do you have to have a neurologist on staff or on retainer or available? And this amendment just gets to the middle of that. The reason mental health professionals is in there is that we found that it wasn't just registered nurses who did utilization review. It was also mental health professionals.
I think the cost is going to be one heck of a lot higher if you have physicians that aren't trained in that subspecialty area to be in charge. We're talking about saving money up front to have good medical care, so that in the long run, it won't be so expensive. This to me would do the exact opposite, and I think in the long run would cost a lot more money. And they're paying these utilization review folks too. That's costing some money. Let's have quality work, not quantity.
Sure, we're gonna have to make it things everything as brief as we can, just because of the.
Representative Reckman, when you're addressing that, are you really referring to the registered nurses portion of it, or are you referring to the mental health portion?
I don't have my mini classes with me, so I'm having a problem. Yeah.
Look, you're talking about the doctors and trained.
Oh my God. <That's right. laughs>
I think they're number twos.
Right? Yeah, I wear one.
Line 17, where we're addressing registered nurses or mental health professionals.
Well, that stays the same.
Yeah, okay.
Doesn't affect it.
Yeah, but the physicians really addresses the nurses, not necessarily the mental health professionals. I think that's the concern that I have.
Well, these are the supervised by physicians.
That's correct.
And then are these physicians trained in the specialty area or are they not? That's the issue. This medical.
Well, they're the psychiatrist.
And in order to supervise, you have people working all week long. That means you've got to have somebody doing that, a physician, to be supervising them during that whole period.
Well, there is going to be someone supervising them. The question is, are they trained in the specialty area or not? That's the issue here.
To me, Mr. Chairman, the issue is not only that, but the issue is whether or not you're going to have a physician supervising throughout the entire period of time. So you have your utilization. authorization review, you've got to have supervision by a physician trained in this appropriate specialty area to carry out the utilization review activities. So it says you've got to have somebody there. If you're providing the service, you've got to have somebody there full time supervising that service. And that's what I think the whole essence of the argument is about the cost the representative talked about.
I would agree that it may certainly bear upon the cost, Jay Parnell, but I don't know exactly how it bears on this amendment, because the amendment only goes to the question of whether or not they're trained or not.
I understand Representative Parnell's point now. He's talking about the second part of the sentence, and he's probably right. It is sort of a confusing sentence. I'll try to read it again. Requirement that a private review agent have available the services of sufficient number of RNs or mental health professionals as appropriate, supported and supervised by physicians trained in the appropriate special area to carry out utilization review activities, or have available appropriate numbers of physicians, etc. I'm not sure what the or have appropriate numbers, what that is the alternative to. I think that's what Representative Parnell is getting at. So Catherine's telling me that it's an alternative to the nurses or mental health professionals. So here's the way it is. Mm-hmm. You have to put an A before registered nurses or mental health professionals and a B before appropriate number of physicians. If you don't want to have registered nurses or mental health professionals, it's always an alternative to have the appropriate number of physicians actually doing it. You can have the physicians do it or have registered nurses or mental health professionals do it under the supervision of the physicians. That's the way it is and the bill is written. If without this, with the amendment, then it's going to be registered nurses or mental health professionals supported and supervised by physicians. I don't believe that precludes the second part of the original part. I don't believe that precludes them having physicians involved. Probably the point of the way it's written is that that's the practice, is to emphasize registered nurses and mental health professionals because they're cheaper than having physicians. I doubt that it has any practical effect of precluding things. The thing still boils down, now that we understand the sense better, it still boils down to the same choice on the point you made before.
Trained or not trained?
Yeah, and then Mr. Chairman, in the amendment it says, or have available appropriate, or have available appropriate numbers of physicians. It doesn't say use them. There will be a whole bunch of doctors nearby. It doesn't say they have to use them. In the bill it says you use them. I mean, you have a choice. You use the doctors or you use the trained professionals and nurses with the doctor overseeing and actual usage of those folks. This amendment would dilute it entirely, because you could have a doctor in the same building that has nothing to do with the process, and they could, the amendment is...
I can appreciate Dr.'s point of view on that, on that point. And I guess what I'll do is withdraw the amendment if that would make the
Chairman. Sure. So objection to withdrawal the amendment.
Good.
Well, I have... Can you say it,
Abbott? Just turn it down. Just for the interest of people on teleconference, we've completed all the public testimony at 3 or 4 meetings previous to this one. We have people online in case there's any questions from committee members. We've got 16 minutes to complete about 7 more amendments, so we're going to go as quickly as we can. Appreciate anyone who is online taking the time to do so. I'll offer amendment number 3. Now, what we're in here... We're now talking about final determinations, which is another stage of this whole process. And the issue here is specialty or subspecialty. And it's, again, the same issue as the last one. I'm not going to offer any new arguments. I think it's basically the same decision. So any further discussion on that amendment?
Vehemently objected.
I think you're being opposed to every amendment. We'll vote on all amendments. All in favor of Amendment 3 indicate by saying aye. Aye. Opposed indicate by saying nay.
No.
1-3. Vote. Amendment number 4, please say that payment will not be denied for treatment rendered as found medically appropriate within college coverage. This is the whole issue of what happens when we get to pre-authorizations. And we also have a provision that affects us on page 4, line 16. We're saying here, provisions that in the absence of fraudulent information or material misrepresentation prohibit retrospective denial of payment for treatment. except in cases of policy limitations or exclusions. So this amendment deals with page 3, line 26-27, which is a phrase that says, and that payment will not be denied for treatment rendered as found to be medically appropriate within policy coverage. I think we've done enough on this number 13 on page 4.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brown.
I just have a question on that. The way it reads presently, that would mean that the utilization review agent could make that determination. And I don't think they do they? I think the insurance company makes that decision. So this is supposed to be for the reviewer, not for the insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
So the reviewer doesn't have the obligation to deny, or they make a recommendation, but they don't deny it. So we'll assume that this would be appropriate to be in there.
Well,
so the deletion would be appropriate.
The way it works, just to explain, let me explain the way it works, is it doesn't matter if your agents or sometimes insurance company signs outside, but they someone comes in, I want to do an XY operation, they get pre-authorization, they go through the procedure, the question is, does the insurance company pay after the fact? And what I believe 13 on page 4 says is sufficient. Provisions that, in the absence of fraudulent information or material misrepresentation, prohibit the retrospective denial of payment for treatment except in cases of policy limitations or exclusions.
But how does that fit with the title? The title is healthcare review agents. And the agents don't have anything to do with denying.
No, that's what the agents do. The utilization review.
That's their whole job now, to make that decision.
They play a role with, I don't know how exactly it's laid out contractually. Some of them are in-house people. I think Aetna uses in-house people. Is that correct? Other people use contractual relationships with utilization review companies, but either way, these companies make a determination, and they have some contractual relationship with the insurance company, so that their ruling holds.
Yeah.
I think that's how we've gotten to this point, which is a much bigger point than this amendment. We want to explore it later. We should.
Maybe the title should be changed.
It's possible. We can ask that question when we get through this.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to plot this. Representative Brown.
This is a horrible amendment. If you read the amendment, it would eliminate the requirement that a qualified review physician confer with the patient's attending physician, and the effect would be to allow the review agent.
No.
Who's
we're
paying?
We're looking at some other amendment.
This is amendment 4, isn't it?
Page 3, line 26-27.
Right, amendment number 4.
Yeah.
Okay.
It only gets rid of, and that payment will not be denied for treatment rendered that is found to be medically appropriate within policy coverage.
But it gets rid of that. That's extremely important to keep
but it's already
payment
in.
Wouldn't be denied.
But it's already, we're saying it.
It's repeated twice at least.
Okay, I guess I won't say. But I do believe that it is already covered. We actually have a more detailed policy in 13. I think it's redundant and could be confusing in interpreting this. They use different words. This one here says medically appropriate within policy coverage. The other one says policy limitations, exclusions, misrepresentation, or fraudulent information. I think we have to have one standard or the other.
This one sounds better than this.
Okay.
It's simpler, isn't it?
I do prefer the amendment. So there's opposition to the amendment.
Mm-hmm.
All in favor of the amendment indicate by saying aye.
Right.
Aye. All opposed,
yeah.
Say nay.
The
vote
is.
You don't have to rub it in. So the vote is 2-2 on that amendment. Representative Parnell and Finkelstein in favor.
That is just fine.
Hey, this is fine.
I think there is, just to get back to the question you raised, Mr. Chairman, I think there is probably a valid reason for having it stated both ways. Because in the instant case in paragraph 7, it's stated in the positive. And in paragraph 13 on the next page, it's actually stated in the negative.
Okay, that's amendment number 5 I'll offer. Amendment number 5 gets to the issue of who contacts the attending doctor? The way the bill is written now, that it has to be a physician with the utilization review agent. If we adopted my amendment number 5, we'd allow any UR staff to make that contact. Seems like a relatively technical point, but the sponsors of the bill feel like it's important because they don't want physicians talking to people who aren't physicians and trying to make these determinations. In offering it, I feel like it's important just because of the cost involved.
I'm going to oppose this just because I can't.
Yeah, I think you're opposed. All you never know, I might wear you down by the time you get sent. Any questions before we vote on this one?
I haven't figured it out.
See, what's
what you're really saying is, under this paragraph, current law would require that they cannot deny it until an appropriately qualified physician has talked to your doctor.
Right. And the issue here is you still, they still couldn't deny it, but the difference would be it only have to be a utilization review employee.
Your doctor would only have to talk to the utilization review person.
Right, which would be a nurse or a mental health professional. Or it could be a physician. It would give all options.
The real war here has been between the docs.
Right, but does the utilization review agent have to, do they have to have physicians carrying out this role? I mean, is it necessary for these, you know, interactions that occur for to be a physician? That's what this issue comes down to.
Right, I agree.
But, okay. But it also comes down to, Mr. Chairman, that if care has been denied, of all times, that certainly should be reviewed by a physician, certainly not by a private review agent. It should be by a qualified physician in its subspecialty.
Right, this is the, you're right, the determination was a separate thing, correct about the previous, this is the conferring that occurred.
Exactly, but this would dilute again, this amendment would dilute that requirement that when coverage is denied, that an appropriate physician be consulted with. It would delete that, and I find that very inappropriate. Again, we've got the bill.
If you're going to stay with number five, you've got to stay with this one.
Right.
But you stay with four, you mean?
This is eight. I don't mean amendment. I mean number five.
Oh, I see.
Paragraph five.
Okay. All in favor of five indicate by saying aye. Aye. All opposed?
Nay.
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 One to three. Amendment number six, page four, lines three and four. The way it would read, right now reads, the requirement that a determination that care rendered, being rendered, or to be rendered is medically inappropriate must include a written evaluation and findings of the reviewing physician. And the change would be, if this amendment was adopted, is the principal reason for the determination. It's basically the amount of information that has to be made available. This gets back to the whole point that was made in testimony on both sides on what they've got to produce, how much of it is information that is internal information, whose purposes is served by releasing the information, whether it undermines the purposes of trying to do the utilization reviews to make all the evaluations criteria public. And the argument for it is clearly that it provides more information as to why they made a decision.
But I think for me what it does is it forces the reviewing agent insurance company to have their doctor put his money where his mouth is. In other words, he signs, fills it out, and tells you, the patient, why the care was inappropriate and that they're not going to pay for it.
Right. And now that's true either the with or without.
I want the doc doing that.
Right. But Representative, that's true with or without this amendment. With this, without the amendment, they have to do that with additional information. They've got to give evaluation of findings, which you is implied to be something longer. They still have to put their name on the paper, and they still have to state why they did it with the amendment. They only have to give the principal reason for the determination.
I agree. I think the subtle difference here is
the amount of information.
Is the amount that the doc himself must provide as opposed to the reviewing agent, which he is supervising, that he just signs for.
Operator?
I see your point. Would it make you more supportive than it said principal reason for the determination of the reviewing physician? See, I think it's implied. I think that's just a drafting thing. I think I'm trying to differentiate here between written evaluation findings and principal reason for the determination. I was sort of ignoring of the reviewing physician. I'm just trying to resolve this point. Would you support it? The shorter version of it if we still had enough of the reviewing physicians.
You mean so as to delete written evaluation and findings?
And stick in principal reason for the determination.
As opposed to the...
To the findings.
Well, I really don't want to create more paperwork for people, and we may be doing that by requiring full written evaluation and findings done just by the physician. All I really care about is that the physician himself stated what the reason is for denying the appropriateness of the care. And in the previous amendment to the paragraph, we've at least got the insurance company's physician now has to discuss with my physician why he's going to turn us down. And I think if we're going to go that far, the very least we can have is that insurance company physician at least putting down, as you've indicated, Mr. Chairman, the principal reason for his determination that care was inappropriate.
Okay, so
because basically, if care is inappropriate, you're talking malpractice.
And then I'm going to modify this amendment then just to say delete written evaluation and findings. So that's the amendment before us. Other reviewing physician is gone. The same concerns on both sides still apply. It's just clear now what we're talking about. I'm not adding any new argument for or against this.
Would you repeat what you suggested?
Delete written evaluation and findings.
In other words, as I said.
And leave out, but take out other review physician. That's not in that line. We're no longer deleting that. That still stays in the sentence.
Yeah, leave of the reviewing physician in, just take out the written evaluation findings, but I thought you were going to insert in their place the principal reason.
Oh, that's the second line, insert principal reason for termination.
So
yeah, if you look at the amendment, you'll see. I'm just talking off the amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
All I do is change amendment number 6 slightly by striking the words of the reviewing physician.
Right, no, I understand that. I
think I can show you.
Yeah.
If we just delete this.
I think we understand what we're doing.
No.
Yeah. Then it becomes one sentence reading like this. Principal reason for the determination of the reviewing physician.
Correct.
Oh, I had it vice versa.
Just delete the circle part, and then it becomes one sentence.
Thank you, Robin. I had it vice versa. I still object.
Okay, it's been objected to. All in favor of amendment number 6, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, and if you
nay.
Nay.
The reason we have is writing, why didn't we argue?
The only difficulty we have, Mr. Chairman, again, is that...
I was Representative Parnell. Taylor Finkelstein.
Okay, but again, we have the committee taking action on a vote, which I just note for the record, I don't think we can.
I'm certain of it when it comes to amendments. You may be right on the other, but I'm certain of it on amendments. And we've operated as a rule that way on amendments. In fact, we even allow members, or we've been told we allow members by teleconference to vote on amendments.
I know. I don't think it's appropriate. I just wanted to note it for the record. But even so, it's adverse to the way I voted, because I'd rather see this amendment take place. But even so, if we're going to be consistent, I think I had to note that for the record.
Okay.
Where does the same spell have to be written down? Huh? Okay.
I think it's written down. Yeah.
It's
amendment number 7, I'll offer page 4, line 10. This is a... This says allows any on-site review agent, even a part-time one, to enter a hospital and talk to a patient without prior notice to the attending doctor. The problem is that when you say full-time, I think what is really meant is in-house. Some company may decide to have a half-time nurse at a hospital instead of a full-time nurse. And I think we're trying to say here, if they've got an on-site review agent, they're allowed to do it. They just may not be able to afford a full-time on-site review agent. They may be three-quarters time on-site. I mean, that's the differentiation escapes me.
Jeff.
Does everyone understand this one, or anyone want to ask any questions? Representative Brown?
It occurs to me, perhaps I'm reading it wrong, though, that this bill would allow a review agent to bother intrude upon a patient at any point in time. It would be the only person that could do that besides the physician. Frequently, patients, in the doctor's orders, no one is to bother that patient, no visitors. This would allow the on-site review agent carte blanche at any time.
But remember that the sponsor bill already allows it, see. The bill already allows it.
The bill says right now, it allows them to go in and do it. If they're full-time. I don't think
full-time.
I do either.
No, I just don't understand that differentiation.
I don't either, David, so you're not alone.
If they're on site, they're basically made themselves available. They have a relationship with the hospital or with the provider. They're sitting there. They got an office. You know,
right.
Something's going on. I don't completely understand the nature of this relationship, but I don't think the full-time is going to do it. The patient, you know, can say no to talking to the person.
The paragraph doesn't make a lot of sense. It says prohibitions. What prohibitions?
Does that mean
the hospital may post, or the doctor may, the patient may? Who may post the prohibitions? Who's responsible for creating
the plan shall include these prohibitions. It shall include all these things. All these things are requirements. And the prohibition is against a private review agent entering a hospital, interview a patient, unless the attending physician is advised, etc. But this paragraph does not apply to an on-site review agent. I could be singular, I suppose. I'm not clearly sure why prohibitions are plural. It's just a drafted thing.
I guess my question is, why are we excluding the on-site review agent, whether they're full-time, part-time, or have a contract, why are we excluding them from the prohibition of interviewing and prohibiting anyone who happens to have an office outside of that particular hospital facility from coming in to do the same kind of review work?
It's just sort of practical. If they have to go out and inform every doctor every single day of all they're going to do, it's just going to become a burden and eliminate the value of having an on-site review agent. What they're required to do here is they've got to go advise the physician with a reasonable advance notice. I wish I understood all these things better, but my understanding from discussions and testimonies is a different relationship when they have on-site review agents, and I don't think we're going to get to the bottom of that. The question is, how do you define these on-site review agents?
I guess my question is, why should we prohibit the others?
The other people from doing the same thing, the people right. who are apart? Then you'd want to strike all of 11.
If you struck all of 11.
But
There may be contract review agents who handle a limited number of carriers, you know, one or two carriers, let's say, and they don't have a lot of patients in various hospitals. So when a patient shows up in the hospital, they go out and they do a review, an on-site review. They walk on to the place, see if the guy's getting his leg set or whatever, you know. Why is that person any less onerous than the guy working for Aetna or something who happens to have an office right in the facility and be every day full-time on-site?
Well, why are they any more onerous is the question.
Yeah,
either
way.
The fear of the providers is people just marching in without, you know,
notice,
setting up ahead of time, without informing the physician. It's some sort of intrusion into the, you know, situation they've got there, and it's a reasonable standard. And I don't think I would support getting rid of 11. I think it's, you know, a reasonable line. I'm just trying to solve this one little thing, which is defining who these on-site people are who get the exception.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they don't have to be full-time. That's my only point. My point is very tiny. It's unrelated to this bigger question.
Right.
And we aren't taking testimony. That's the problem. Let's just decide this. If someone else wants to offer an amendment now or in future committees on this bigger issue of whether 11 should be in there or whether it should be completely expanded, I think we can entertain it. But I'm just trying to solve this one thing. Is there objection to? Right, there is objection. All in favor of amendment number 7 indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed indicate by saying nay.
Aye. Thank you. Might let you win one.
I think I'll go along with you. I can't really see a major problem on that part of it. I still don't. I think the overall question I want to have answered, though, before I vote on this on the floor, is whether or not 11 is even necessary, whether or not we need to exempt or exclude on-site agents from some prohibition that's enforced against all other review agents. But I'll leave that question for another day, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Chairman, is there anywhere in the bill that says a patient can say yay or nay to the review agent entering their room?
Nine is page 4, line 18.
Did you just leave, right?
Yeah, I didn't. Someone else can operate it, though. I don't know what's going to operate. The issue here is, what are the acceptable reasons for a retroactive denial? It's an issue we talked about previously. Is the fact that a policy or the alleged fact that a policy was not enforced an acceptable reason for a retroactive denial? You know, the issue here is, what if someone hasn't paid, you know, they're called up, they're asked to make a pre-authorization, they make it, it turns out, though, the person hadn't paid their policy. Their judgment was given based on the medical facts given before them, but they don't really have coverage. You know, are they stuck paying for something they gave, paying retroactively for something they authorized when they never had coverage in the first place? I think probably someone would interpret it that way anyway, but this is just a clarifying amendment. Representative Taylor.
Well, I think part of the problem here is, who do we look to that has relied upon this assertion? And the people who rely upon the assertion that coverage exists and the reason that you make the phone call in the first place
is that the hospital and the attending physicians and all the other care providers, before they start providing care and incurring significant costs on your behalf, want to know that there is coverage. Now, Joe Blow, coming in for his hysterectomy, he comes in there for his surgical procedure, and he has called in advance, and he has gotten preclearance. The hospital now has a copy of the preclearance, and the review agent's been contacted by the hospital, and everyone agrees that this surgical procedure is appropriate, necessary, and that he's covered. The hospital goes ahead and provides the services, relying upon that pre-authorization. Oops! 4 months later, somebody in the accounting department determines that the guy hadn't paid his bill, so that actual coverage didn't exist in the first place. Therefore, a hospital loses. That's what actually happens. The guy, he still has to pay for it, right? Because we who receive these services, we owe for them. We just happen to carry insurance, about 60% of us, if we're lucky enough to have it, so that somebody else will pay for part of it. We still pay for some of it. Now this guy gets to pay for all of it. He can't afford it. The hospital can't get it out of him. But they were led to give him these services by the insurance company that authorized it. And I think it's a kind of foreseeable damage when the insurance company steps in and says, yes, we believe the contract is good. Yes, we think these services are appropriate.
I think
at that point the insurance company is bound to pay for them. The insurance company always has the right to go back and sue the guy that got the services provided for if he was not entitled to them.
The part of my motivation in some of these effective pre-approval is I like pre-approval. What happens if you have all this burden that says if you give any of these things, you absolutely have to pay for them, they're going to stop doing pre-approval. Because they're going to say, why should we risk being stuck with this person? We'll just wait until after the fact. Pre-approval is essentially a system to make it easier for the providers and the patients to figure out what's happening. And it turns out a few percent of the time, they deny them. And this, you know, is just another element of it. You have a good argument, I think. You know,
I'm only looking at who's in the better position, Mr. Chairman, of knowing whether or not this man has coverage. It's why we are required to turn to the insurance company in the first place. As a care provider, we're forced to turn to the insurance company to find out, does this man have coverage for his broken leg? And we find out, yes, he has coverage for his broken leg. I mean, they know better than anyone whether or not he's covered, whether or not they're going to have to pay for it. That's why we called on them. And it's certainly not within the hospital's resources to turn to the guy and say, do you have coverage? Have you made sure and paid each of your bills? You know?
Well, you make a good argument. I'll withdraw amendment number 9.
And what happens to the person who, in good faith, makes application?
Okay, is there?
And then gets hit by a car, and they didn't process it in time.
Right.
And he's paid his check and the whole...
Is there objection to my withdrawing amendment number 9?
No objection.
Amendment number 10 is just an attempt to try to get a clear definition of what we're talking about here. Page 6, the existing one says, the utilization review means a system for reviewing the appropriate efficient allocation. I don't know, now that I look at it, compared to some of the things we're talking about, I'm not sure this is that big a deal. Anyone have any comments on that?
I just want to read it and see what happens. At least section 5.
I'm trying to back up action on this bill. Consent is first. You're welcome to object to that.
We couldn't find out what the difference was. This includes electric requests for clarification coverage.
I can't particularly make the case for 10 in the 30 seconds I have available to me. I was convinced before it was a better definition, but it may well not be.
Wait a minute. I think I can tell you what it is. What they're attempting to do is to exclude those requests made on elective surgeries or elective procedures where they're merely making the request for clarification of coverage purposes as opposed to the actual receipt.
But it isn't electives as elective coverages. It's not like you pick to get coverage for mental health services. It's the request itself is not required. It'd be on, it could be on some core part of the policy, and you decide you're just going to get some clarification. You're not asking for pre-authorization. You just call up and saying, hey, you know, do we cover mental health, you know, or do we cover this? And they give you some advice. I've done that. I've never used pre-authorization. But I've called up and I've said, hey, you know, are you guys going to pay for a pair of glasses for me? You know, I mean, is that the standard? I didn't tell my name. They didn't look into me. I just said, I'm this policy, and do we get one pair of glasses per year for 2 years? And they give you the answer. It's standardized, not fitted to your circumstance. It's just like the ethics committee. You can ask the ethics, the legislative ethics committee for advice, and it's non-binding advice. It just gives you advice. If you want a formal advice, you have to ask for a formal opinion. You just can't call up and say, hey, I got a problem. Tell me some informal advice. So this just says they can still give informal advice. But I'm not convinced it's a big deal anyway. Does anyone feel strongly about this amendment?
Well, apparently people must be concerned, or they wouldn't have offered the amendment, that there may be misuse of the utilization review as defined in here to force the carrier to make a determination up front of what its legal position will be on, as you've indicated, Mr. Chairman, other matters or peripheral matters that may, in fact, result in a greater liability to them than they would expose themselves to by just saying, yes, an appendectomy is appropriate. In fact, I do have some overall concerns about the legislation in general from that point of view. If, in fact, I went in and had a series of procedures done in a hospital, only to find out that my carrier said that some of those procedures were inappropriate procedures. I would think that in and of itself might very well be a claim against the attending physician or hospital for rendering those services to me and billing me on them. Because obviously I've got another physician that says those things were inappropriate in that instance. So, you know, it may very well be that they do not wish to get caught up in that process. And they do not wish to get caught up in the process of determining on an overall basis whether or not they are liable totally for the in other words, they are responsible for the things that you have you've asked. I'm probably not phrasing it very well. I think I understand what you're getting at, and I think it's a more serious amendment than we're probably addressing here.
So your view on the amendment is?
Well, I certainly want to study a little bit, but I am concerned about that from an overall perspective on the entire
question. Okay, well, if members don't understand the amendment, I will withdraw it because we don't have time to do any further coverage to it.
I just think it's something that needs to be discussed in the next committee of referral.
Right,
yeah, I didn't receive any.
Just a real quick statement. I think it's a shame we have to use utilization review. Well, I certainly am concerned about the cost of health care. It's gone way up, and it's unaffordable to so many people. But I still believe firmly and strongly in the individual concerned with their own position as to the best techniques appropriate for that particular person's body, not a panel of strangers who's, you know, that looks at a piece of paper and says, hey, this sounds good or bad, or it's going to cost a little bit more kind of thing. And I feel like we're this one. You know, a few centuries down the road, and we're pushing a computer to see if I can go get a hysterectomy or my earning growth toenail taken out, when, damn it, I know that's what's right for me. So, thank you, Mr.
Chair. Well, I agree with Representative Bruckman's frustration, but I think I can sense a reason for these review groups and agents, primarily because for some period of time I had the opportunity with an insurance carrier to review claims, about 5-6 years worth. And during that period of time, I was appalled at what some physicians do.
Okay.
And that is that it's not uncommon to see physicians who are milking the Medicare system, Medicaid system. That's been reported in the newspapers and so on across the country, where they'll stack a hospital full of their patients and go through and do bed checks 4 or 5 times a day because they get paid X amount for each bed check by just walking in, looking at the patient, knocking off another $50 or $25 or whatever every time they walk through the room. Chiropractors are something else on this stuff. You can get chiropractors coming into your community where every other day that patient has to be going back to that chiropractor for another adjustment, which gets charged to the insurance policy, and they practically live there. Now, it may very well be that the person has something that could be cured by an orthopedic surgeon. But they believe, their faith is in chiropractors. So they believe the chiropractor is doing them the right thing, and you as an insurance carrier are stuck with it. Well, if you can go in there and review that, say, hey, wait a minute, we're not going to pay you for 5 years of massaging by the chiropractor. Instead, we think it's more appropriate for you to go over here and get your back fixed. But right now, my God, there's doctors. We see them coming into this legislature. There's holographic doctors. There's vitamin doctors. There's acupuncture doctors. We don't even know how to certify them.
Holistic. Holographic doctors use holographs.
So that will be coming too. I don't doubt that there will be some group appear here in a couple of years wanting to be certified and licensed for that purpose.
Used now, my driver's license.
But I agree with Representative Bruckman. I'm frustrated by it too, but I don't know any way out of it, especially when thee and me are the ones that are paying for all this. And we're paying for it, whether we're paying for it in the form of higher insurance rates, each of us, because the hospitals nail us that pay harder for the ones who don't, or whether we're getting nailed here as state legislators as we provide for Medicaid and Medicare coverage, Medicaid in particular, is going clear out of sight.
So, any more amendments to come before the committee? What's the wish of the committee?
Representative Bruckman? Mr. Chairman, I would vote for this request out of committee with individual rights.
Is there any objection?
No.
Hearing objection, approved. Anything to come before us? Being adjourned.
What if this comes to us before it passes?